So, hello, listeners. I'm here today with Mark Citadel, and we're going to be talking about the various differences between tradition, conservatism, and reaction. And broadly, this is not going to be so much a discussion format where I try to grill somebody or we discuss a difference. I'm really here in more of an interview capacity to explore reactionary ideas. I've seen Mark in a variety of other interviews online, and he seemed very knowledgeable about a type of thought that I think conservatives and Christians generally are not very knowledgeable about. And so I decided that I'd just have him on and ask some interview questions. So I guess I'll give a little bit of an introduction. So I'm reading from your blog, and it says, Mark Citadel is an Anglo-Russian metapolitical theorist and geopolitical analyst writing within the broad school of reactionary thought as a part of a burgeoning online network that has come to be known as the Reactosphere. He's an Orthodox Christian, once described by critics as a pretty consistent ideologue. And I'll point out here that that's a big O Orthodox Christian, because I consider myself a small O one. So is that a, do you want to elaborate on your biography at all before we start on the questions, Mark?
No, I think it's reasonably explains enough, I think.
Okay. So I guess I'll start out with the question about neo-reaction or reactionary thought itself. So can you explain what is meant by reactionary thought or neo-reactionary thought, and perhaps give a brief overview of the history of reactionary thought?
Sure. Well, the term reactionary comes from the French réactionnaire, which was used as a slur in the very early 1800s against opponents of the French Revolution and the Enlightenment, particularly against figures that are very well known in traditional Roman Catholic circles, figures such as Joseph de Maistre, Louis de Bonald, François-René de Chateaubriand, various figures such as that. And it came to be adopted, as so many terms usually are, as a sort of a badge of honor. So it was originally meant as a kind of an insult, but it was adopted by later right figures who basically redeemed it and said proudly, so we are reactionaries. I'm not entirely sure where the first use of the term conservative is, but it is definitely distinct. These two things were recognized as distinct even before the American tradition of conservatism arose. You can see differences in the strand of thought, and I often characterize them as being conservatives sort of see their duty, as the name suggests, to conserve the status quo, whereas a reactionary is somebody who wants to return to the status quo ante, what happened before the status quo. In the case of France, of course, the return to the ancien regime. And this presents a very different political philosophy, in that the reactionary is sort of grounded in a kind of a view of history which is, I guess you'd say, bifurcated into. And he prefers and advocates for the first and original view of metapolitics and metaphysics, whereas the conservative is always in motion. He views things as being of their time. It's often said that when Gorbachev was bringing down the Soviet Union, the against him by the old hardline Soviet generals, that they were the conservatives of their time, and indeed they were. In every sense, I mean, they had grown up and had been integral figures of a system that was all they knew, and that system would be completely torn down, and indeed deeper than that, not just the Sovietism itself, but the very sort of notion of what Russia was, would be torn down by the end of the Cold War, and that was a revolution that they wished to oppose, and so they were the conservatives of their time, but of course they were communists. So you wouldn't class them as reactionaries. Reactionaries appeal to this older idea of tradition, which is the status quo ante.
I mean, I think it's kind of deceptive how it's defined, because reaction seems to imply it's being defined relative to a progressive or a progression in society. Mm. And I think that in some sense, almost the exact opposite is true. It seems that the reactionary ideas see themselves as being more independent of any force of the age, essentially.
Well, I mean, they're definitely in opposition to the force of the age, which is why this term doesn't really have an equivalent prior to it. I've often said that the reactionary is the traditionalist in motion, in that he's, and when I say in motion, what I mean is that he has something to react against. The traditionalist doesn't have to react against anything because there's nothing that opposes tradition. Even opposing political forces all operate within the same basic traditional framework, whereas the reactionary is dealing with people whose political dissent is entirely divorced from his way of thinking in a way that represents a fundamental break or involution from tradition, which was defined by early 20th century thinkers as being distinct from tradition. They made a distinction between tradition with a capital T and tradition with a lower T. Tradition with a sort of lowercase t is just any human practices that accrue over time, whereas this tradition with a capital T was really representative of that status quo ante, not limited, of course, to the regime of King Louis in France, but representative of basically all of human history from the Enlightenment back into the primordial era.
And so I think I've heard a little bit about De Maistre and these people. Can you perhaps go a little bit further into some of the key things that they held to be true or key criticisms they had of the revolution and subsequent political ideas?
Yeah, well, I mean, most of it stems from opposing the Enlightenment view of human nature in a way that I think many conservatives would actually hold to today, that man is not this figure as described by Rousseau. He's not this person, sort of bountiful, beneficent human nature that enters into the social contract and is wonderful. And the only thing that is wrong with him is these poorly constructed institutions which tyrannize him and force him to do evil. Maistre completely deconstructs Rousseau in a book called Against Rousseau, which I recommend everyone read. Actually, for me, it may be my favorite of his works. He completely takes him to task, whereas somebody like Edmund Burke, I don't think Edmund Burke ever really tackled Rousseau's philosophy. He never did, I don't think he ever wrote anything deconstructing him.
Which is so odd, because yeah. Burke, you know, I know quite a few Catholics that consider themselves thinkers. They all know Edmund Burke, and very few of them seem to be familiar with De Maistre.
Well, that may just be a symptom of the Anglo-American sphere and tradition. I think French Catholics would be quite familiar with Maistre's writing. There is a bit of a dichotomy between continental philosophy and the philosophy of the Anglosphere world. But Maistre set up this. I would consider him really, as much as Burke would maybe consider, I think I've heard him called the godfather of conservatism. Maistre is the godfather of reaction. And Maistre is actually a little bit younger than Burke and did cite Burke quite a bit in his books. He considers Burke to have been a good thinker, but he does diverge from him in many ways that sort of would define the reactionary position, which I think would come across as quite alien to particularly an American audience and to some extent Canadian, Australian, and British audiences as well, because it is a very continental philosophy. In many ways, it would be better understood by Russians than it would be understood by Americans.
Yes, I mean, or perhaps even modern Frenchmen.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, France has both been the seat of revolution and reaction since time immemorial, really. I mean, all the way up to the early part of the last century, there were explicitly monarchist, hierarchical, anti-secular forces and traditions. You know, you can only have to look at Charles Maurras and Action Française, which is really the last proper expression of this. And of course, today you have the French Nouvelle Droite or New Right, although I would actually say that they are quite a departure from the reactionary tradition and sort of branch off into the, how to describe it. I don't want to say sort of Nietzschean right, maybe the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of sort of the Nietzschean element in people like Richard Spencer and other alt-right figures.
So yeah, and that does come from that tradition of Alain de Beauvoir, Dominique Venner, Guillaume Fay. These are French thinkers who largely reject the the sort of explicitly reactionary politics, and while they have some ideas that are certainly taken from that tradition, they deviate in many other ways. And I think that Nietzsche acts as an influencer in that regard, as he really was throughout the last century on what we would today certainly term the right.
Yeah, it's kind of odd because I think Nietzsche has been a major influence on both sides of the political spectrum.
Oh, yes, yeah, indeed.
And, you know, in some sense, insofar as the modern sort of reactionary movement understands Nietzsche, it's sort of, I think, a more suited opponent for a progressivism that really descends itself from Michel Foucault and stuff like that, who also were deep into Nietzsche. So it's interesting, but I don't want to sort of derail us. Perhaps we could go on a little bit about more of De Maistre's ideas. I remember you mentioned something about basic beliefs, and
yeah,
I don't know if you want to continue to elaborate before we sort of trace the historical thread to our own time, I guess, but
sure,
we want
sure.
to pause a little bit further on the French reactionaries.
Yeah, I mean, this I would hesitate to say that Maistre would put it in these terms, but these are the sort of, this is a simplistic summation of it that I can bring forward, which I did bring forward in the podcast I did with Tara McCarthy on the history of the right, that there are these sort of properly basic beliefs that Maistre attested to that were primordial and divinely given. They weren't rational in the way that natural law is rational, and this is another key difference between Burke and Maistre. Burke often refers to natural law, despite I believe he was an Anglican, but Maistre, even though he's a Catholic, never appeals to natural law. He avoids it like the plague. And I think the reason is he had an almost a very stoic conception of natural law. He saw natural law as being something that was just sort of imbued into people. It didn't develop over time. You couldn't develop it or gain new insights regarding natural law. It was just something that was sort of written on the hearts of people. And those who sort of dissented from it were literally just dissenters. They weren't trying to develop it or doing anything that was in any way good. They were brigands, he would call them. But he certainly felt that there were these primordial truths which were inherent in all civilizations, although he certainly viewed Christianity as having a huge role in why European nations developed the way they did. I think he referred to other places where other religions predominate. Basically, these internal truths have to manifest themselves in slavery, in forms of slavery, because there's just no other way, because men are evil and you have to chain them. He has a great sort of response to Rousseau's comment about man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains. And Maistre says, sheep are born carnivores, but everywhere they eat grass. And his idea was that man is supposed to be chained. Man has to be chained because the vast majority of them are inferiors and are morally obtuse and prone to wickedness without the guiding hand of their superiors and the sovereign authority. And he thought these were embodied in traditional institutions, the church, the crown, the aristocracy. He believes in these things. He doesn't have many economic viewpoints, which is one of the interesting things. He never really addresses economics at all, unlike Bonald, for instance. Bonald took a hatchet to Adam Smith. But Maistre doesn't. Maistre seems to actually almost assent to the sort of our modern conceptions of economy, which I think is one of maybe his failings. But he his general ideas about authority and hierarchy being natural to man and absolutely essential, for once they're torn away, this kind of whirlwind engulfs the state. And he described the French Revolution as just this non-human entity, almost like a hurricane that went through. This is something that he witnessed personally. Of course, this is another difference between him and Burke. Burke was not really affected by the French Revolution. He was either in retirement or very close to retirement, whereas it completely altered the life of Maistre, who was forced into the kingdom of Piedmont Sardinia as an ambassador while he sort of watched his country go up in flames, effectively, because they had dissented from these properly basic beliefs, which he considered that dissent to be providential. He considered it to be God's destruction of the French people for essentially being sinful, and this would be the complete desolation of all of their institutions and everything they held dear.
So, to go forward, I want to go forward, but I have a question. I mean, it seems from it implied that perhaps de Maistre did not see all elements of the Ancien Régime as being good or healthy or natural. Did he regard, say, the Louis XIV, Louis XV period as perhaps decadent or impious?
He had quite negative views of the last king's handling of the situation. That's again one of the points of this providential destruction that he believed was brought upon France because of this. In no way was he against things in principle. He agreed with the principle of things, even if he could accurately point out the flaws of any given leader at a time. I haven't read too much of what he wrote on the king himself, so I don't know how laudatory or how critical it is. I'm simply going from the other sort of things that he wrote in general. I think they imbibe a principle of almost to quote a much later figure, there have been bad monarchs throughout all of history, but monarchy itself has never been bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting idea, but let's just, before I start sort of pushing back, but asking sort of questions that are occurring to me now, I guess how does this idea sort of progress forward through time, right? Because I think, I hear a lot about is reactionist sleep for hundreds of years until the 20th century, or are there additional thinkers that sort of develop it?
No, there are thinkers. Of course, the 1800s, I mean, this happens right at the tail end of the 1700s. The 1800s are less about thinking and more about war in Europe, really, because it's this sort of Napoleonic era. It's the era of Metternich. As they say, Metternich is the military sort of embodiment of reaction, in that he's trying to cage and end this revolutionary sort of fervor that is being spread with Napoleon. Now, of course, Napoleon himself was sort of almost an imperial figure. He doesn't really embody the ideals of somebody like Robespierre, for example. But still, with him was coming this philosophy of republicanism. And there was, it was mainly a military effort to contain that, but that's not to say there weren't intellectual developments. You can draw a very clear line from Maistre to the Spanish diplomat Juan Donoso Cortez, who is still cited quite a lot. Terrific writings. He wrote a very long book called Essays on Catholicism, Liberalism, and Socialism. I believe that's the order they're in. He's probably the first reactionary to tackle the issue of socialism. You've also got, again in Spain, Father Felix Sade y Salvini writes a book called Liberalism is a Sin, which I'd recommend for every Catholic to read, because it's an incredibly interesting book analyzing basically papal state.
I have recommended that book by many a Latin Mass Catholic.
Ah, well, that's good. It's good to know that it's known, because otherwise it would be quite obscure. I mean, he was quite an obscure sort of priest, but
I actually don't know anything about it other than the fact that it gets forwarded to me by people.
Yes, I'd recommend you give it a read. There is somebody who's done a reading of it online that's quite good, but that's an important work, and doubtless there are others. It's simply that because of the limitations placed upon me, I can't speak for all things in all languages. So, I can only speak for what's been translated into English, mainly. And that's only happened really in the last 60, 70 years. Some of these books have only just come into we've been able to read them. The 1800s, like I said, it's more military than intellectual, but the intellectual tradition continues. But what you have to bear in mind is that for roughly half the continent, there doesn't need to be an intellectual tradition, because this is just normal. This is considered normalcy, and everything that's going on in France and elsewhere is just considered insanity. There's this divide. It's not like all over Europe we are at this point the people who are on the out of politics, really. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, or it's seen as a uniquely American phenomenon of some type.
Mm. Yeah,
or like liberalism, that is, right? Because it certainly exists in America at this point. But I imagine this at some point culminates, because there's another explosion of reactionary thought in the early 20th century, right?
Yeah, oh, indeed. Like I've already mentioned Action Française, but of course you have the German conservative revolution, figures like Oswald Spengler, Otmar Spahn, Edgar Julius Jung, Carl Schmitt, various others. These are massively sort of influential. Of course, you have the traditionalist school comes in, Julius Evola, René Guénon, Fritjof Schuon, and Ananda Kumaraswamy. These incredibly important figures, and they expand, I would say that particularly the latter expand reactionary thought to a global proportion. It's no longer just sort of this very Catholic dialogue between Catholicism and liberalism. It becomes worldwide, and actually other traditions are brought in, particularly the traditionalists bring a lot of stuff back from India and the Hindu religion that informs in quite a sort of astounding way the condition that we're currently in a vivid way. And of course you get Orthodox writers begin sort of writing on these things. You've got Ivan Ilyin is one of my favorites. I'm actually reading a book by him now, White Emigre from Russia, who sort of argued against it. He was observing his own revolution, very similar to Maestre in a way. He had to sort of flee the country because revolution gripped his country, a different kind of revolution, but one with some of the same metaphysical sort of underpinnings of liberalism.
So what do you think are those metaphysical underpinnings?
Oh, just the exact opposite of everything I've said. They are the idea that man is essentially good, the institutions make him bad, and therefore you just have to sort of reform the institutions and you can fix him, you can make man, you can bring out the best. In fact, even if you just provide the institutional backing, man himself will bring his good nature forth. And of course, this is bound up in secularism, it's bound up in anti-clericalism, the idea of separation of church and state, just the explosion of atheism and disbelief, rationalism. That's another key point. It's viewing everything on a rational basis, not simply the superficial things in life. You find that rationalism...
Yeah. Rationality has to be something that sort of runs astride the world as opposed to being a specific tool used for particular applications.
Yes. Yeah, well, indeed. And Maestre actually said... rationalism is perfectly fine and a useful tool when it's maintained and it stays within its grounds in the realms of the physical sciences. It's when it steps over those boundaries into philosophy that it must be firmly told that it is out of its area, because it will wreak all sorts of havoc. And Maestre is really the progenitor of what I described as the open obscurantism of reaction, that it believes that these fundamental truths, Maestro refers to them as the national dogmas, must remain completely impervious to reason and must be shielded from reason. And any reasonable person, quote unquote, who approaches them with a sort of an eye to analyzing or particularly deconstructing should immediately be hit with the harshest and most brutal and gruesome penalties. And those are the only things that can stabilize a society.
Because these are, in some sense, pre-rational premises, right? They don't... It doesn't make sense to essentially diagnose them with tools that,
You
can't
exactly
re-diagnose the axioms of a system with the logical force of that system. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, yeah. I often say that the West has essentially reasoned itself into suicide, because that's where reason will take you if you take it too far. The assumption that, we should base our entire society on reason is to apply to man the quality of omniscience. It's to imply that we... in our limited life and with our admittedly limited cognitive abilities can know everything, can break down those, what's the analogy? I think it's called Chesterton's fence. The fences that we don't know why they're there, and thus we have to sort of analyze them. And if we can't find a reason, we tear them down. But the reason that we may not be able to find a reason for those fences may simply just be because those reasons are beyond us. It doesn't mean the fences are unreasonable.
I think I love that analogy, by the way. Obviously, I'm a huge Chesterton fan. But the thing is, I encountered this philosophy. I think I was a progressive at one point. And, I was an anti-interventionist, which I still am. But I remember listening a lot to Noam Chomsky when I was a progressive. And Noam Chomsky seems very, very erudite and knowledgeable whenever you catch him on the side of American foreign policy. But I remember him talking about his political philosophy. And... he's in all this room with all of these very, very studious MIT students all gathered around him by the hundreds. And he has some incredibly friendly interviewer reading him questions. And they ask him, what's your approach to domestic politics or institutions at a societal level. And he's like, well, I think that all institutions need to essentially justify themselves to the highest standard of rationality and empiricism. And if they can't do that, then they should be torn down at their most basic level. And then he's like, well, do you know what's the standard? He's like, well, I think that almost no institutions in a society really can. And, you know, it's sort of this irony because, I mean, at any point, any of these hundreds of students could have sat up and asked why Professor Chomsky was institutionally privileged in that moment. But then they just sit there and, oh, my God, tell us more. You know, the whole structure of the system is essentially organized around a teacher sitting at the head of this gigantic MIT auditorium preaching about why the system shouldn't even be there to support him saying that.
Hmm. Well, liberalism completely relies on cognitive dissonance. It completely relies on having a million and one contradictions. It's why often people call it satanic, because, of course, Satan is referred to as the father of lies. Satan can say one thing and also say another, and they can be both said at the same time, even if they're contradictory. But Chomsky, I mean, that view is not radical. That has been the sort of normal Western view in the post-Enlightenment era. That is what sort of the milquetoast liberal believes. If an institution cannot be justified, then usually, I mean, it's usually secretly oppressing somebody. It's usually a form of secret tyranny. And therefore, you know, we have to challenge it and bring it to its knees.
I don't know if you have a lot to say about this topic, but I'm really interested in seeing how these ideas, how we could use them or to understand the rise and fall of post-war Buckleyite conservatism, because to me that's sort of the reigning ideology in a lot of groups. And the question is, you know, is Buckleyite conservatism something that is a force in and of itself, some kind of position that could be used to govern, or is it sort of like the rear guard action of essentially the Noam Chomsky idea that you have to just put this question to institutions and tear them down if they can't justify themselves?
Well, I mean, Buckleyite conservatism is I would say it's really the post-paleo conservatism of America. And you're right, it does retain, I'd say, dominance, although how secure that dominance is today, of course, regarding the last election, is very questionable. But Buckley is... Does it form a rearguard action for... Do you mean like a rearguard action, like conservatism is essentially a rearguard action of liberalism? That it basically conserves its gains? Yeah, this has been the observation.
You can elaborate on that thesis, but I've heard this coming from reactionary thought quite a bit. And yes. I mean, it seems... I mean, you know, this criticism was made, I think, 20 years ago. A lot of people who are probably, I'd say, like more moderate... I'm not moderate. I hate that term, moderate. But a lot of people who I think would be in my circle in terms of religion, right? You know, small orthodox, but, you know, don't take us too far to the right. A lot of us would think that would be ridiculous. You know, it would have been fusionism all the way. You know, what are you talking about? You know, we got to fight the good fight. But now I think that this idea that conservatism is just the rearguard action of liberalism, or even the rearguard action of progressivism, of even farther left-wing forces, is now suddenly incredibly compelling.
Well, indeed. I mean, Buckley, I think, once described himself as a happy warrior. I'd maybe refer to him as a happy traitor. As much as someone in the American tradition can be called that, of course, because Buckley is working within an American framework within which reactionary thought simply is just not present at all. It doesn't have a history. You know, because America is a revolutionary state, so its conservatives from the earliest conception would be class, what we call today, and I'm starting to really loathe this term, classical liberal. And I think many conservatives actually even define themselves as such. If you press them on it, they say, I'm a classical liberal.
What do you think that
they might even say something like, the progressives aren't real liberals.
I've heard that a lot, but what do you think this classical, it's supposed to evoke Burke, right?
In a way, but I don't think Burke described himself as a classical liberal. Burke was steeped in the English tradition, which is a weird tradition. relative to Europe. It's very odd. I mean, England, and I speak as somebody with a considerable amount of English blood, and I've grown up here, and I know the culture pretty well, as much as England still has a culture. But it is very similar to Russia in a way, in that it is in Europe, but it is not really of Europe, or rather it's of Europe, but it's not really in Europe. And as such, its thinking has always been kind of marginal to Europe. No European country really had the political setup that England did. And I think that that influences Burke's thought, and Burke can only, although of course he's known for basically almost endorsing the American Revolution vis-a-vis the French Revolution, he really can't be understood outside of the particular English tradition. And I think he has to be seen as, he's not the father of American conservatism. His thought is different from that. He believed in an established monarchy and an established church. And I think he would have been much happier if Washington had put a crown on his head and declared a Church of America. You know, he would have loved that. But that's not what happened. I think American, what you've seen regarding this rear guard action is, and this is, of course, I think a modern observation. I don't think earlier observations of this are as full in their analysis, mainly because I think we've been given the chance to analyze it that previous generations hadn't. But conservatism, certainly it conserves the fights of yesteryear that it lost. So conservatives way back when fought, you know, for the issue of absolute states' rights in America, for example, you know, the position that states really should get to govern their own affairs, and that the government certainly should not come in and dictate what private citizens do in states. And yet today's conservatives are defenders of the Civil Rights Act in America, which completely undermines that. And they will call you all manner of horrible names if you disagree with that, you know, even if you're sort of a crackpot libertarian and disagree with it on those grounds. So conservatives, like I said, they grow up and want to conserve the status quo that they grow up with. And that is, it's not the status quo ante, and it always changes. So today's conservatives will condemn yesterday's conservatives, or they'll ignore their faults. For instance, take Russell Kirk, right? I think you mentioned in your email, Kirk. Kirk was basically a counter-Semite. You can look at his comments regarding neoconservative.
Well, can you clarify what counter-Semite means?
I use counter-Semite to distinguish it from anti-Semite. Use anti-Semite to describe people who are have a sort of abstract anti-Jewish notion, usually based on racial or sort of ethnic pure, you know, the kind of stuff that came out of Germany in the 30s, for example. I use counter-Semitism to describe anti-Jewish sentiment that is more anecdotal. So something from lived experience. And Kirk's main criticism of neoconservatives in his mind was that their real loyalty was to Israel, and that they were constantly basically duping America into doing Israel's bidding, even when it was not in the interests of the American people. Actually, a neoconservative called Midge Dechter attacked Kirk, saying that his line about them sort of being loyal to Israel was a bloody outrage, quote, a piece of anti-Semitism by Kirk that impugns the loyalty of neoconservatives. He said that people like my husband and me put the interests of Israel before the interests of the United States, that we have a dual loyalty. And then she goes on to say, it's this notion of a Christian civilization. You have to be part of it or you're not really fit to conserve anything. That's an old line and it's very ignorant. So, I mean, even by today's standards, of course, nobody ever mentions this about Kirk, but Kirk did not.
Yeah, I never heard it myself.
Yeah, Kirk was very Christian. He was very devoted. And in fact, there's in his writing on Burke, there's a good reason to suspect Kirk actually did believe in establishing a church. Believe that Christianity should be an established religion in the United States. It seems that he was arguing for that. And he was very suspicious of Jewish presence in the sort of the right milieu, which certainly came to pass after, I'm trying to remember what it, I think it's when sort of the Democrat Party becomes aligned with, or sort of crypto aligned with communism. A lot of Jews who were previously in bed with the Democrat Party switch over to the Republican Party, and they become the sort of war hawks, very anti-Soviet. You know, we've got people like Bill Kristol coming in around this time, who's still around today.
This must be entirely an intellectual phenomenon, because I think the Jewish community votes overwhelmingly for the Democrats.
Oh, yes, so. Yes. That has been the case throughout. I do mean intellectual Jews, and these are usually non-practicing Jews, so they're not they're not religious Jews. They're just they're secular. But he, I mean, Kirk was extremely skeptical of that. But then, of course, Buckley, who I think proclaimed himself sort of the biggest disciple of Kirk, he is the one who actually excommunicated the John Birch Society for its supposed anti-Semitism and its conspiracy theory surrounding communist plots in the US. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, that's a very vivid example of how the conservatism of tomorrow erases the conservatism of yesterday in just a continual pattern, whereas reactionary thought is more permanent in its beliefs, because it believes that the Enlightenment and that era of history was not just a sort of a next step. You know, in a way, the conservative assents to linear history, assents to the liberal linear history. He just believes that liberals are sort of going in the wrong direction and doing things that are awkward. But the reactionary actually does not believe in that at all. And thus he sees the French Revolution as a fundamental break from history rather than a sort of development, as it were.
Sure. But why do you think the cracks are forming in this sort of neoconservative, post-war conservative ideology right now? You know, I think that, like I said before, 15 years ago, if I had the relative position I had right now, I think that this would have been more or less unassailable, but now I think you see the cracks forming in the fusion coalition all over the place. And I don't think it's just Trump. I think there's an intellectual way that these cracks are forming too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's definitely beyond Donald Trump as just this sort of weird character who's really the most Teflon person I've ever seen in a campaign. And I've observed a few campaigns. I would actually say that the reason for it is entropy. The reason for it is that progressive change, if you want to call it that, has now become so rapid in the time it takes that you can no longer have these sort of generational handoffs, so that conservatism sort of peacefully transitions. It peacefully transitions from a Kirk to a Buckley over, you know, I think that's an 80-year period or something. It transitions through that. I mean, now we have to go from something like sodomite marriage is just completely unthinkable in early 90s to you will literally lose your job if you dissent against it only a couple of decades later. And I mean, we've gone from it just being civil partnerships to marriage so quickly. That's just a seminal issue in that it is one that is emblematic of how fast things are going. But conservatism's appeal to people really relies on liberals going quite slowly. It relies on this kind of incrementalism, but the problem is that liberalism has an entropy to it that it increasingly speeds up. The velocity increases as the change continues, which is why you end up with situations like the Mizzou University incident, where black youths are demanding their lily white 100% liberal deans leave and step down because they're guilty of institutional racism, when these people are probably most institutionally anti-racist people you could find.
These guys can't hand money to them fast enough, right? I mean, you've seen the Evergreen College thing, which is it's a college that's about 30 miles south of here. It's like a hyper liberal. I call it sort of like it's like the hippie Bob Jones University. Modern American universities weren't liberal enough, so they created Evergreen. But they demand all of the teachers who are white get off of campus. One of them dissents, and then there's this huge outrage. And you hear the letters from the deans and the chancellors, they're pleading with these students to essentially cease their protest. And they're offering them money and programs and everything. It's like they're begging these people to take their money. And it's still not good enough. It's still, you know, it's hard to see what can even be, it's hard to see how it could accelerate faster in some sense.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. I think that liberalism is this kind of moving shadow, and it casts a penumbra. And as long as conservatism can stay within the penumbra, as long as the penumbra is moving slowly enough, they're fine. And I think a majority of people who are naturally right-leaning will be suckered in by conservatism and will want to, you know, fight that good fight and be a happy warrior. But when the penumbra moves so fast that the conservatives are almost uncovered for the spineless figure he is, I think, that is represented in today's National Review so well, then people begin to break off from him. They begin to look for other solutions because conservatism is not offering a proper opposition. And I think even Kirk presages this. He says that conservatism is never more admirable than when it accepts change that it disapproves with good grace for the sake of a general condition. You know, people are fine with that if that takes place over a generation because they're not really affected by it. You know, it comes in, the big change sort of comes in at the end of their life and then they're dead by the time it's fully sort of implemented. Whereas now it's happening so fast that people are not happy with those who are going to accept changes that are extremely destructive with good grace, especially something like a mass migration, for example, which is why I think Donald Trump completely overthrew the establishment in the last election.
Well, I think that, and you say it's the speed of the change, but I also think that there are one or two bright lines that just couldn't be crossed by progressivism that were recently crossed. And maybe I think gay marriage is one of them. I think it's too foundational to Orthodox religions to have it be essentially colonized the way it is by the progressive movement and then used as a weapon against Orthodox religions. I mean, I guess you could argue that Orthodox religions just need to be, you know, the next iteration of the status quo would be now conservative religions exist as, you know, pariah faiths underground. But I think that, you know, I don't think that was going to happen. I think what progressives tried to do with gay marriage was a big bright line. I also think that, you know, when it comes to deplatforming conservatives, there's just no way that you can dignify, like, you know, when it comes to Charles Murray, who sort of like, I guess he sort of dabbled with some ideas that were popular among people who are broadly reactionary, but other than that, he's more or less your standard issue.
Moderate
conservative.
He's completely moderate apart from the bell curve.
He has to essentially beg for the right to speak at a university where students want him, where he has a right to speak by the rules of the university. And a university that takes tax money that he pays. I mean, at that point, how can you, at the point where a moderate conservative has to essentially beg for a platform on a university that he pays for, that's a bright line that I'm not so sure that there's any, you know, dispensation of progressivism that can make that look not pathetic.
Yeah, I think that's bad in general, that obviously the no platforming thing is, you know, but I think that's an issue that is faced by academics. So I think we can signal and we can get outraged about it for as much as one might want to. But I don't think that actually affects, I really think the thing that is, if you want to point to something that's amplified rather than simply just pointing to the speed of it, I would say it's migration. Because I think that's the only thing that has a very tangible, immediate impact on people and makes them quite afraid. The gay marriage thing, I mean, I don't think you can point to sort of American Christians being just so wedded to the idea, the purity of marriage, because of course you had no-fault divorce come in. And I think many commentators are right to say that was the destruction of marriage, really. Yeah. Ultimately, that's when the numbers began to completely collapse. And nobody opposed it. In fact, you know, many evangelical groups in particular just sort of changed their ecclesiology on it to accommodate it. And nobody cared. And also, you know, you do point out correctly that there were instances of people being, I would say, I would use the language persecuted for not kowtowing to this. You know, we've heard of florists and bakeries. But these are kind of isolated, weird cases, usually of vindictive people who go looking for a lawsuit. And yes, they're horrible. You know, I don't like seeing them either. But again, I think that's quite distant.
These people drive past numerous gay bakeries and gay florists to find the people that are these little grandmothers in the hinterlands of these large urban areas that, you know, that they know might actually resist them. They're testing. They're literally going through the countryside shooting, you know, destroying the unrouted units in the culture war. Migration is the problem that it sort of it pulls out the brake entirely, right? Because once that occurs, you don't have any power to. The demographics change to the extent that you don't even have the power to change things hypothetically in the future.
There's an instinctual thing, I think, that's even in today's completely sort of degenerate, typical white Westerner, there's something genetic almost, which sort of sends up an alarm bell ringing that says you are not going to do well as a minority. And the thing is, I mean, Richard Spencer is correct to say being a minority is bad. It's not good if you're a minority. Why, if we acknowledge that being a minority, if you're black or you're Native American or if you're Asian, is bad, why would white people in America, and that's the primary issue, why would they celebrate becoming a minority? Surely there are reasons that it's bad for people, and people naturally want to avoid that. And of course, every day on TV in America, I know I lived there for 5 years, every day on TV, there's another person saying, look how demographics are changing. Demographics are destiny. The GOP particularly needs to change its platform, or it will never win another election because minorities just won't vote for it. I mean, there's quite a sinister undertone to that. And I think even if you don't live in an area with high migration, you know, maybe you don't live in a big city, maybe you don't live in the Deep South or these border states that are being flooded with Central Americans, I think that you have an inner sense that there is something quite sinister going on, if not for you, for your children and grandchildren. And I think that's the issue that really animated people in the last election.
Well, certainly. I think, you know, it's one thing. It always surprised me that progressives are so, they're so shocked that conservatives are against these demographic patterns when they spend half their time gloating about it, you know. But there's also another bright line here that was crossed with the fact that I think the narrative always was that assimilation would take care of this problem. But I think it's become manifestly obvious that we don't teach assimilation at any level of school. So I'm wondering, you know, you have someone like me who would be a standard Fusion conservative at another age, and you're like, well, we don't teach it. Was this ever part of the dispensation that was being promised, that these people would assimilate into becoming essentially, you know, like previous generations of Americans?
I mean, even if you're completely not racially conscious at all, and you want to go down the route of, I think, what goes by the moniker of the alt-light, and say that it's really all about culture. It's really, even that doesn't work because it relies on the magic dirt theory that people come to places and they'll just magically become like you just because they're on the same dirt. And it's not the case. If you want a stark example of this, just look at Europe. The people who are coming to Europe from sub-Saharan Africa, from the Middle East, and from North Africa, they are not becoming the next Bachs and Beethovens. These are becoming the rapists of thousands of British girls in Rotherham. They're becoming the gropers on the Cologne subway. They're becoming the bombers at the Belgian airport. This is the generation that we're raising up. And if you think that there is less of a cultural break and less of a distinction between America and, white Anglo-descended Americans and the people who occupy Central and South America, who are the main immigrants who are coming. I mean, the black population of America, actually, contrary to popular belief, has held pretty steady for 100 years. It hasn't really grown. They usually kill too many of their children for it to grow. But the Hispanics, then I recommend you go and look at some of the things that go on in these Hispanic countries, some of the gruesome murders that take place that are just incomparable to anything that you see in America. I watched a video on Live Leak of a prison riot in Brazil. And I'm sure you've seen footage of prison riots before in places like America, you know, where there's sort of shankings and things. In this Brazilian prison riot, where the guards had to retreat to the outer towers, and looking in, you still have film of it. It's like something from ISIS. They carve people's heads off. They cut a guy's chest open to pull his internal organs out. And actually, one of them started biting into his heart. These Hispanic countries, to a greater or lesser extent, are very influenced by their pre-Spanish legacy, which was as different as you're going to find to a modern waspish life in America. So I have no.
I guess the thing is, I have been a racial skeptic myself. I'm notably agnostic on the subject of race realism, but I tend to think that the mutability of races is actually an indication that religion can form them as much as the as much as them forming religions.
Change them. Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a legitimate case to be made that Africans, for example, in Africa are much better off living under Christianity than they are under Islam, because Christian Africans don't go in and cut out their daughters' clitorises, for example. Mm-hmm. You need something to almost mediate the genetic sort of impulses of certain peoples, and Christianity can actually do that for more brutal souls out there. But I definitely think that the racial question is something that is urgent, but also it's ensconced within a whole broad range of issues. I definitely would not recommend people focus on it entirely, because then they end up with this narrative.
I mean, that could be part of the problem, but I think that it's possible.
Yeah. I mainly focus on issues of political fear. I've dabbled in some gender stuff as well, simply because I think a lot of the racial stuff is about hard science, which I'm not qualified in. So I leave that to people like Steve Saylor and the other people over in the sort of HBD sphere to talk about that, because it's an empirical science, a lot of that stuff.
Well, to move on to other topics then, I guess, sure. I mean, so do you think that basically what explains the popularity of sort of the neoconservative models, and do you think it's just cowardice? Is that why they're so popular in sort of contemporary Orthodox small Orthodox?
No, I think that, I don't think there's any sort of weird explanation of their popularity. They're of the time. They're of the moment. They are the conservative, I do think they're fading now. But they were the conservatism that was right for that period and that age, right being the operative word. It was the conservatism of the Cold War. I honestly don't think the conservatism of the Bush years was any different to the conservatism of the Cold War. And yeah, I think John McCain was
let's run the Cold War idea policy on Islam
against Saddam Hussein. Yeah, it's I think it was just for the time, and its effectiveness was in the fact that it was very effective at purging and getting rid of the previous generation of conservatives. I mean, you just look at the treatment of Pat Buchanan, for example, a noted paleocon. He was completely sort of purged out of acceptable conservative publications and thought. Because his ideas simply became out of date. And that's the story of conservatism. You know, if you don't move on, if you don't eventually kowtow to liberalism, you will be denounced by people who call themselves conservatives as being, a throwback medievalist, an extremist, etc. And they will use all the sort of liberal insults that they once made fun of against you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's becoming apparent right now, right? You've got, I mean,
of course, yes.
All of these, what was it? Was it David? There's a particular Christian. I'm going on my soapbox now. There's a particular Christian. I think it's David Blankenthorne. He was. I don't know why I'm bringing this guy up, right? This is him. He was this huge proponent of same-sex marriage. He's an opponent of same-sex marriage all throughout the 2000s, the 2005s, and I want to be charitable to this person, but I absolutely despise him. He was one of the people arguing in the Supreme Court against gay marriage. He was one of the people, who I think was the Defense of Marriage Act. He's a big proponent of that. And then in 2012, he decides, oh, gay marriage is great. Let's do it. And he goes on this tour where he just denounces all of his former colleagues, all of the conservative Christians who are...
Is this Michael Corrin? It's not Michael Corrin you're talking about, is it? Because it sounds exactly like him.
Well, I guess this is... Yeah, this might be a... this is an archetype. I guess this is where you're proving your point, right?
It sounds exactly like what Michael Corrin did. I don't know if you know who he is. He was a he was basically the head of traditional Catholicism in Canada. He was on the network called Sun News. He wrote loads of books on traditional Catholicism and opposing liberal reforms. And then today he is the most, I think he went to Anglicanism. He's the most sort of paused liberal. He denounced everything he did before. He did an apology tour. It sounds exactly the same.
This is just an archetype of this force. And it's just, what's so strange is that, like, he essentially did, he sort of leapfrogged the whole Rod Dreher, we just have to sidestep the position altogether. And he went straight towards, people who don't do this are bigots. And I think this is totally unsustainable. I mean, this is, the mask falls at that point, right? So I guess we're moving on sort of the questions of the contemporary age, which is what do people do about this? I think, people are sort of asking what comes next. And I guess I'm thinking that there might be answers in sort of older reactionary thought for a lot of people who find themselves in positions where they're looking at Corins and Blankenthorns and asking themselves what the hell happened.
Well, increasingly, like I said, this velocity is not going to slow down, and so I think conservatism just becomes increasingly untenable for any serious person to hold. I think you actually have to grab onto something solid if you want to oppose liberalism, and the only solid thing, really, to my mind, is a reaction. I don't think you can go and look for illiberal ideologies such as National Socialism or communism and grip onto those and say, this is how I will oppose liberalism. I think those things are dead. But reaction, even though it's been sort of forgotten, it never dies because it's perennial. It was around for so long that it's within everybody, I think. Nicolás Gómez Dávila, who was a Colombian reactionary thinker, a terrific thinker, represented sort of, I think, a high Colombian tradition before Colombia became the hellhole that it is today. That's just sort of drug run, horrific place. I'd say back then Latin American countries were much more European in their type. I think they've completely degenerated today, and drugs have a large part to do with that.
Certainly.
But he said that the reactionary viewpoint and the traditions that he holds, they're like these sort of sacred shades on eternal hills, I think was his poetic expression, in that they're never destroyed, they're simply waiting to be picked up again, they're simply sort of lost and awaiting to be found, almost like the mystery of the grail. They never die because they are inherent to who we are, and this is this goes back to Maestro's thought. He didn't think that he completely dissented from the idea of a social contract. He believed that civilization was a sort of divine gift and that it was within all people to naturally and organically form these kinds of societies. And that's the thing. Everything we see around us today is artificially upheld. If it all went to shit tomorrow, if it all just collapsed in on itself, what kind of society do we think would emerge? Would it be a nice, pleasant parliamentary democracy? I don't think so. I think that we would see the return to traditional forms because these are just normal. They're normal for human beings, and they're considered normal still in many other parts of the world today.
Now, in some sense, you could look at reaction as sort of being the concept that there is sort of a collective soul of the Western man that reasserts itself, by contrast, there's sort of a bill or imperfection that continuously needs to be confronted. And even technology cannot completely obscure that, I suppose.
No. Technology is just a mask. Mencius Moldbug of the neo-reaction, the progenitor of neo-reaction, which we mentioned earlier, famously said that technology masks social decay, which would otherwise be obvious. And I think that is the case in our modern era. In fact, probably the reason that there was such an upsurge of right-wing thought in the early part of the last century was that you had the very strong progressive change, but technology had not yet caught up enough to distract people from it. Whereas today, there are just distractions everywhere. But the chaos itself is growing larger. We're dealing with the destruction of our sort of traditional lives and meaning in our lives, and the great institutions which are supposed to undermine, particularly the lives of young men, are just disappearing. And so, of course, they're going to be they're going to be looking for answers. And I think that in these traditions, and what I've tried to do throughout my writing period, started in 2014, is to bring these to light for English-speaking audiences and have them be able to sort of read them, comprehend them, and try to sort of apply them to their own worldview.
I mean, it's a good question at the point. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, at the end of the day, there's no guarantee in a way. These things, they can be found again, but they can only be found if there's somebody there to find them. And the thing today, particularly with regard to Europe, is that the people themselves are dying. It's not just their culture's dying. It's that the people are actually literally demographically dying out. And once they're gone, you can't recover anything of that. And I think even you go back to the writings of Oswald Spengler, he predicted that it was the end, basically, for Western civilization. He said that it had entered its sort of winter. It's the winter of civilization, and it was basically going to be erased. And interestingly enough, he predicted that it would be picked up by Russia. He actually predicted the Soviet Union's eventual collapse. He predicted Russia would return to roots that were older than the 1500s and would actually sort of envelop Europe, which is interesting because Spengler is regarded by many to be a sort of an anti-Christian figure on the right. He famously sort of associated Christianity with Bolshevism, but that's actually it's not really accurate because Spengler was a huge fan of the works of Dostoevsky. And yes. In Dostoevsky's sort of the Christianity that he represents in his books, Spengler actually said that the next 1,000 years will belong to the Christianity of Dostoevsky.
Which is Orthodox, which is smaller Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah, indeed, but I don't think it was even particular to Eastern Orthodoxy sort of as a dogma. I don't think that's what he was referring to.
I meant Orthodoxy of just the nice.
Oh yes, yeah. What I think he was referring to was he was seeing in it a sort of the same Christian spirit that had underlined the Ghibelline Middle Ages, that sort of era. And he saw that as heroic, and he saw that as actually the real destiny of Russia, which I think was remarkably perceptive on his part for that era, because so many Russia would return. They thought that the Soviet Union was basically the end of Russia.
Well, but Russia isn't, I mean, Russia, I appreciate its culture and it is part of Christendom, but it's not really the West. It's not.
Oh, no, really, no, not at all. No.
I mean, the West starts at Germany and Austria, as far as I'm concerned. And I mean, if Russia subsumes that, then essentially we've said that in some part, a significant compartment of Western civilization has eternally died.
Well, yes, but that's what Spengler predicted. Spengler did not think there was any return. He did not think there was any going back because he saw things in terms of cyclical development. And he thought that Western civilization had achieved its apex and it was now heading into a deep, deep decline. And he did think that it was going to die out. I don't know if he would have predicted that it was going to be under the same kind of threats that it is today, because it was very hard to predict back then the immigration question. I mean, that must have seemed absurd to people in the 1920s, the idea that European countries would just allow massive, massive flows of people from North Africa practicing Islam into their countries. But I mean, that is what is happening today. And I think that's what Western Europe is going to be swamped with, because Western Europe is so spiritually and culturally weak. And the people who are coming in are, in relative terms, though we wouldn't want to say absolute, they are spiritually and culturally quite strong. And the strong do what they want and the weak suffer what they must.
Yes, as the famous Greek proverb goes. But I mean, that's the question. Once Silicon Valley and the Euro institutions, the welfare state Euro institutions collapse out from under Western man, exactly how much life exists in that void, I guess, right?
Yeah, the aim of my sort of work has been to try and preserve what you can, because I do think there are still people who hold a traditional outlook out there or are capable of holding it. They are a minority, of course. I do hold René Guénon's principle that this is only going to be for a very select few. It's only for a select few people who have the spiritual aptitude to really perceive the problems of the modern world and revolt against it, as Evola wrote, But for those people, I think that they can actually carry what is valuable about their heritage and history and culture into the future. And those that can't will just disappear. They will just disappear from history. And we have a long record of cultures and peoples simply disappearing from the record books. It does happen, and we'd be foolish to think that it cannot happen today to modern nations in the West. It is already happening.
It absolutely can happen. But I think...
And conservatism is doing nothing to stop it.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I think you know, this is the thing. I think me as being someone, I recognize that personality-wise, I'm a natural a Buckleyite conservative. I recognize that about my personality, but it's just too obvious. It's just you know, I think you know, I realize my own cognitive flaws, and it's just the reality of the world we live in. It's strong enough to overcome those cognitive flaws. Just like you'd have to be an idiot to not see this. But let me pose a question to you. I guess getting into our future, sort of our view towards the future at this stage. So you seem to be very much thinking that a collapse is inevitable. I tend to be a person who thinks that collapses might happen, might not happen, but I say that if there's any possibility for non-collapse or any possibility for even a very quick rebuilding after a collapse, there just has to be some avenue by which we can convert, or as people in more new right-wing movements like to say, red pill, a lot of people who are now progressives or who are specifically moderates inside the class of modern urban intellectual elites. And specifically of the Generation X variety, or older millennials like myself. Well, and yeah, I'm wondering if you think that's possible.
On to target.
What?
Generation Z is the one to target.
Well, no, Generation Z is the one to target, but the thing is that Generation Z, I mean, maybe you're not thinking at a different time frame to me, but Generation Z is not going to have any institutional power. To my mind, we need enough of a voice in the institutions to essentially not lose them entirely, you know, over the time period which you want to target Generation Z.
Hmm.
And the thing is,
it's very hard to predict the timeline. Is the thing you just don't, not helped by the fact that figures are routinely distorted and kept from us in various countries, so we don't know the kind of time frame we're working with.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But I mean, do you think that progressive? I mean, how convertible do you think progressives and these modern intellectual elites are? I guess
I think anyone is as convertible as anyone else if they have a high enough intellect for it. I've met people in these spheres who've come from a range of weird backgrounds. I've met former communists, I've met former libertarians, former anarchists, and indeed former progressives. I myself was a former conservative. I never really went through a liberal or left-wing phase. Mm-hmm. I think anyone can come to this. I don't disagree with Moldbug's writing his an open letter to open-minded progressives. You know, how far it gets, you know, I don't know how many people are willing to listen to those things. Like I said, it's a small number of people. I'm not for the alt-right's mass movement approach. I abhor popular movements. I'm very much in the Evolian vein in that respect. I think that when movements become popular, they tend to be completely diluted. And I think you saw this with Trump. You know, Trump had to become so popular with everyone that he's eventually become just basically sort of a yes man for the establishment. I mean, there's nothing really that's changed dramatically. Illusions were kind of shattered recently when he attacked Syria.
I don't like mass movements either. I think that what we're really talking about is a change in understanding of the universe, right? A change in this idea of progress from people's conceptions. And maybe that's going on,
but the thing is, I'm
not seeing it.
I don't think that you can remove that intellectually from most people. I think it's part of the spirit of the age. I don't think you can argue them out of it because they don't believe in it for any kind of argumentative reason. It's not like they were argued into it. This is just all they know.
I look at
the world they live in supports it.
I look at people who are modern progressives. I come from a very progressive area. I was raised in a very progressive area. It was the air we breathed. And I think, I wonder, are people in this situation to me, their thinking makes absolutely no sense. I mean, we grew up together, we learned the same lessons, but it just seems like it just seems totally contradictory, totally dishonest and superficial. So either one or two things have happened. Either they have just at some point in the intellectual development over the last 10 years, they hard swallowed the positions of the radical left, right? They think that all institutions, all tradition needs to be torn down. And they're peddling this cognitive dissonance as a cover to me, as a form to keep their situation in society. The other option is that they're saying the same things I am. And this cognitive dissonance is the process of their minds slowly being lifted from their previous assumptions, which can take a long time.
Yeah, I just don't see any kind of red pilling taking place on a large enough scale for it to matter. I think, and I don't think people hold these positions because they're ideologically locked in. You know, I don't think most people are really sort of hardcore ideological liberals or progressives. I think that they are. Mm-hmm. It's signaling. It's just a way to signal, and it's a game. You have to signal better than everybody else. If you can catch the next wave early, you become a hero. Mm-hmm.
I know that's so amazing, right? Like if you were a person that hopped on the gay marriage bandwagon a few years before everyone else, you were just, you were a hero, and it didn't cost you anything.
The reason it helps you is that you can then point the accusatory finger at people who came later. Mm-hmm. People who jumped on the train later, you can actually get position over them by pointing to them and saying, you didn't really believe it. You just changed with the sort of general opinion. You know, you're like a weather vane. I was the true radical for change, for progress, for human betterment, for human rights. You know, that's it's a very powerful thing. And I think we can't doubt the amount of institutional power that the people I would consider the enemies of what I believe that they have, and that completely enables the system to perpetuate itself. I generally agree that with those who say that you can't really overthrow liberalism. Liberalism has to kind of overthrow itself, and that may seem pacifist to some people, but it is all efforts in the past, I don't know how many decades, to do so have failed, and I don't see them succeeding now because the dynamics haven't really changed. If anything, they've gotten worse for us because people are more divorced than they ever were from a traditional type of life.
I mean, this can't go on for. I mean, I guess I'm just saying the obvious, but it can't. This can't go on forever. It can't be like the people who hop on the Dragonkin liberation movement 2 seconds before I do, are suddenly like the Martin Luther Kings of
dispensation. We say that now. We say that now, but the ideas that they hold today were considered completely absurd decades ago. We may be surprised by what's happening in decades. It may seem crazy to us to think of this, but already there are like 53 genders that everybody has to recognize.
This becomes like a dam at some point. The thing is that I think that there's a possibility that progressives are seeing what we're seeing, and this cognitive dissonance that we're seeing is essentially a process of minds being changed in a way that they can't really reconcile with the lives that they lead. And the second the institutions show some weakness, there might be just a tipping point, and this stuff might actually come about where ideas that were not acceptable become suddenly acceptable, and people just reconsider their position suddenly.
No, I've never seen it happen anywhere, is the thing. I've never seen an example of it occurring where that happened. What I have seen is, in my study of history, I've seen civilizational collapse. It's the only thing that really presents opportunities. And I think, like you said, it doesn't go on forever. The question is, how does it end, right? And I think the only way that it ends is for the entropy to actually play its course out. And then it ends with a kind of massive bang, in a way. And the only question then is, take the reins after that, or does another group take the reins after that? And in Europe, of course, we have an incredibly organized group who could take the reins in the event of collapse. And I, for one, would not want to see that happen, which is why I would like a very strong movement in Europe, particularly of course I've got something of a connection to Eastern Europe, a strong traditionally minded Christian grouping that would be able to resist this and take the reins in the event of that, because I simply do not believe in the longevity of our current political, economic, cultural and social systems. I think that they will reach a point where they will dissolve and implode in on themselves, as Rome did at the end.
I think that's something that is just at its parent. It's that these things can't go on forever the way they are.
I think everyone. It's not a question of whether the system ends. It's a question of who survives it.
It's also a question. And I think which determines hard.
When. Yeah. Well, when it's would it. It's a question of would it benefit us to have it sooner, where we are less outnumbered in Europe, or later, where we've had a chance to really sort of reap the benefits of what I think is another sort of a renaissance in right literature and thought, and bringing intellectually credible people over to our side. You know, this is
which kind I guess of trade-off. How do you think the process of bringing intellectually honest people over to a more traditionalist point of view can be accomplished the best, I suppose? What do you think is necessary for that to happen?
Well, I mean, all you can do is write on the subject, provide commentary on it, and try to propagate that good commentary where you can, and hope that you catch people's ear who are as disenchanted with the present state of affairs as you are. I don't think you go out and participate in elections. I just find that to be absurd. I think that that's a complete waste of time, people doing that. I think that, particularly in Europe, I don't know if America's really learned this lesson yet, but in Europe, that's been essentially what the right has done since the post-World War II era, and it's been nothing but a shambolic disaster. Beyond just writing, I think you have to actually practice it in your own life. You've got to look for a way that you can practice a traditional life and can gather people around you who wish to practice life in that way, and form what I've argued for in a number of articles is a Christian form of what Germans call the parallel Gesellschaft, or parallel society, that Muslims have in Europe. Muslims have created this very ingenious system where they live alongside European institutions, but they're not of them. So they don't absorb the majority of their children. Their children are educated in the way that a Muslim should be. And they are their own distinct community, and they have their power. Christians don't do that, because Christians are still operating under the delusion that they have institutional power when they don't. I would like to, one of my key missions is to wake them the hell up to this fact. And get them to begin organizing like the detested outcast outsiders that they are, rather than continuing to kowtow to people who absolutely hate their guts and want to see them exterminated.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one possible thing you said, writing about this, arguing about this, might be the way to convert people. But I think that the radical movement of the left might present some opportunities that are totally different than opportunities available to the right. Now, I'm not the right person to pursue this, but in the wake of the radical leftward shift of the progressive movement, they're forced to jettison elements of Western culture, cultural artifacts, thinkers, because they're racist, sexist,
of course, yeah.
And so you have entire art forms that may at some point in time be essentially abandoned by progressives, and could be taken up, revivified, and restored by people who are still working in the waiting in the wings of a dormant Western civilization. And this could be potentially a cultural avenue to essentially to show what we've lost, to inspire people to change their perspectives on the world.
Perhaps. I mean, that's a case. I think you can connect people through old culture that they would like to defend. I do think that the thing is that progressives continually do things which are strategically quite stupid, such as taking down the Confederate memorials, for example, which will no doubt galvanize white Southern people to even more to the kind of racial issues that Richard Spencer raises. When really doing it doesn't really even achieve anything. It's no, it's completely symbolic. It's not a material victory for liberalism. So I don't know, but they do these things because it's not a rational sort of conspiracy on their part. It's an occult motivator that they have to act upon. They've got to tear these statues down, you know. But for me, at least, as I said, I would like to appeal to a minority, a small group of people. You know, always quality over quantity. And only a small number of people will be able to understand these ideas. But for the rest, my aim would be, and this may sound somewhat cynical, would be simply to break them from their commitment, their absolute commitment, their indoctrination into liberal ideals and values. I love and thrive on the disenchantment with democracy. When people say, oh, democracy's broken, all the political parties are the same, I'm not represented, I'm not voting. I absolutely adore when that happens because it means people are breaking out of an illusion that the establishment wants to create around them. Now, that doesn't mean those people are going out and saying, re-establish absolute monarchy. Of course they're not. But they enter a territory of simple apathy and neutrality. And people like that are very easy to maneuver in crisis situations to your side. They're very easy to persuade. It's easier to persuade somebody who's completely neutral and disenchanted and disaffected than it is a hardcore zealot. And I think that we need to exploit the current crises of Western civilization to bring liberalism into the same kind of disrepute it was held in the 1920s. But then, of course, we need to, on the back of what I think is going to be a larger general crisis than occurred during that period in Europe, we need to not make the mistakes of the 1930s. We need to very carefully analyze what happened in the 1930s and recognize that there were two potential paths. There was the path represented by organizations like Action Française, Austria's Fatherland Front, Romania's Legion of the Archangel Michael. Mm-hmm. And then there was the path represented by Adolf Hitler and the Nietzschean eugenicist type, very progressive, quite progressively minded rightism, if you want to call it that. But it was this very weird concoction. It was almost the twin brother of Bolshevism in a way. And we want to target that first route rather than that second route, because it's not enough to have just sort of a material understanding of what's going on. It has to be a spiritual awakening. It has to be a complete renovation, as Genon called for. And for that requires people to guide. That requires people to teach, to form the sword, wants to forge the sword of the next great men of history, in Carlyle's words. And that's really what I'd aim to do in Europe. And the people who will furnish their ranks, as it were, will not largely be people we've convinced with arguments and careful debate. They'll simply be the disaffected who need food, shelter, and clothing, and a reason to live. This is what happened in Lebanon. I'd advise people to look at Lebanon after the Israeli invasion and look at actually what happened there and how a group like Hezbollah mainly got what they wanted and got political power, not through violence, but through simply providing people things that the collapsed government was no longer providing for them. Because those people were neutral, you know, they were neutral, and they were looking for somewhere to go. And that's the majority of people throughout human history. It's just a question of who has the reins. It's not who's being dragged along behind.
No, I mean, I think that the two things that are going to convert people are going to be hardship and just the insanity of the left. And I have to say that all of my work is probably going to be dwarfed by the amount of people converted by things like that Bill Nye the Science Guy, My Sex Junk song, you know?
Oh yeah. Look, I wouldn't want to downplay that there are people who are certainly, the craziness of liberalism today is definitely driving people to seek a deeper traditional understanding of the world. I mean, you only have to look at in the growing popularity of Eastern Orthodoxy in Southern America, the deep south of the United States, which I've read about. You know, these are deep Baptist type areas. Mm-hmm. But the people have just become so disenchanted with the culture there. They're looking for anything to kind of latch onto that connects them to an ancient kind of a lineage, an ancient history. And it's happening throughout Eastern Europe as well. Young people are returning to tradition. they are curious about these things, because liberalism is ultimately empty. And I do think that Generation Z does present opportunities for us, and we'd be foolish to pass them up.
Yeah, I think so too. I haven't completely given up on the Gen Xers, because I think that the situation is different. Like I said, I think I'm temperamentally disposed to be a moderate, and I just can't be in the modern dispensation. And I think that a lot of people might be in my position. They might. I think it's at the point where it's very cognitively difficult to be a moderate. It's very cognitively difficult to take the steps that the left wants you to say, I want to get rid of every single thing, you know, except for the institutions that actively contribute to the left's power. And I don't know. I mean, I hate using the word, but you have to be pretty cucked to take that deal, you know.
I've never really met a moderate who was sort of zealously moderate, who really cared. I think moderate's just a description for people who don't want to say, I don't care.
Well, no. I mean, I'm temperamentally moderate. I recognize that. I'm not political. I'm becoming radical, frankly. But right. I understand that I'm temperamentally moderate. I think moderation
I see what you mean.
I'm just saying that, you know, for a person who's temperamentally similar to me, it's very difficult to.
Well, most people are temperamentally moderate, I think.
What?
Most people are temperamentally moderate, I think.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's very difficult. I myself can't look at this world and take a moderate position. And I think that might be an opportunity to try to reach people who in previous generations were potentially unconvertible.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it depends how you play it, doesn't it? It's easy for bad actors to kind of screw things up in a way. And I think this is probably one of the downfalls of the alt-right. It's why I don't think that the alt-right will necessarily be incredibly relevant in the next few years, because certain actors and certain people have done stupid things that they didn't need to do. And it has sort of become this navel-gazing silliness, I think, over there. But then again, I was never that, you know, like I said, I don't like popular movements, and I think the alt-right was the quintessential popular movement.
Okay, so I guess we can move to the last question, which is, what do you think what do you think is the single most important thing that the right, or the people that sort of stand in opposition to the progressive movement, need to accomplish in the next 10 years?
It depends where they are. It literally depends on which country you're in.
Well, I guess we could go for America, and then perhaps we could answer it in America and in Europe separately, I suppose. Western Europe.
In America, I think it is to completely detach oneself from the American experiment, the American legacy, the American ideal of government, the American conception of political life and political reality. To actually sort of discover something of a traditional expression, because for as long as you are tethered to mere declaration, mere independence, mere constitution, mere all of this stuff that is the stuff that you can hear Mark Levin yammer on the radio about for hours on end, and believe me, I used to do it. For as long as you're tied to that, you're going to lose. You're going to lose hard, and eventually you'll be completely dispossessed. Because that's the only place it's leading you. Instead, I think Americans have to, and I'm speaking, of course, of Anglophone Americans, you have to kind of break away from that, divorce yourself from it. And that doesn't mean having any... I meet some of these weird legitimist cranks sometimes who are like, they're attached to some specific monarchy or royal line or something. I don't mean that. To be honest, the last thing you need is have any nostalgia for the British crown or anything like that. God, no. But you do need to think long and hard about sort of discovering a traditional way of life and something that is divorced from the American, this sort of cosmopolitan, particularly bourgeois American experience. I think that may be different depending on which state you're in, how easy that is. I'm sure it's much easier in a rural type state. But to then just, I'm not advocating for moving to a compound in Idaho or anything like that. What I am saying is that you have to find a way to ride the tiger, in Julius Evola's words. You have to find a way to exist within modernity, but reject it, not be part of it, Particularly don't let your children get ensnared by it. That's the big danger. That's, well, again, one of the massive failures of conservatism is it cannot conserve conservatism in children who go off to university and return hating their parents for everything they believe. So I think that's the major goal for Americans, because Americans don't yet have anything that they can appeal to. In European countries, for reactionaries, you can appeal to deep ingrained legendary histories, but America just doesn't have that. But that doesn't mean that Americans can't have a traditional expression, because like I say, the traditional expression is inherent to humanity. It's in everyone. Americans just have never been given the chance to express themselves in a traditional way, because from their founding, they had to be liberal, classically or otherwise. And so I think the main task for them, beyond the immediate political task of, you know, stopping, I think particularly stopping the craziness on the border, is just absolutely paramount, because I certainly do not like where that's going. Mainly it is discovering, what does it mean to be me? You know, Richard Spencer says, become who we are. But I don't, does he even know what he's talking about? Who are we in the American sense? What is even, what unites this group of people? Because it can't just be, we're white. I think that is the most sort of banal, lifeless designation.
It never was a thing in the past.
It's not a thing that resonates in Europe either. I think I agree with Ramsey Paul went to Romania and he said he was talking about white with someone, and this Romanian just had no idea what he was talking about. Because of course, you know, they have sort of more animosity towards Hungarians than towards non-whites of whom they've never met or never heard of. So that's a very peculiar American phenomenon. I'm not saying, you know, he hasn't got a very valid point when it comes to human biodiversity and the racial question, etc. But it goes deeper than that. You can't just have a quote unquote nice white country and think everyone, if only we could just get rid of these people, everything would be okay. No, it won't, because you have a deeply sick society that is grounded in consumerism and cosmopolitanism and secularism and democracy and liberalism.
And we don't want to become Japan.
You certainly don't, because I mean, the thing about Japan is, yes, Japan is very homogenous, but it has such a degenerate culture that they are dying out on their own, and China tomorrow could kick in the door and the whole rotten edifice would come crumbling down. This is what I mean. America has to sort of settle on a traditional expression of itself, and it has to cleave to that. And that's the only thing that's going to preserve the people there long term and satisfy the needs that they have. In Europe, of course, we face a very different situation, because we do have these traditions that we do have to return to and have to call upon, but our enemies quote unquote are far more dangerous, because they're more organized, and I think they're culturally stronger than the ones that American Anglophones face. I mean, it is becoming quite sinister, the situation in Europe. I always come back to Rotherham. I always come back to the number of girls being systematically raped by these people in that city, and how nobody really reacted to it. How it was, you know, it wasn't even the cover-up. It was just the fact that when it was revealed, there was no, you know, there wasn't even a hashtag campaign for crying out loud. There wasn't even a tint your Facebook profile pic thing about it.
Why do you think Cologne had so much of a higher reaction?
Because it all happened in one night, and it was Rotherham, it was reported most of this, it was kind of this ongoing thing that had been going on for a long time, so it was kind of like uncovered, whereas Cologne, it was something that happened in the moment, and crap, this is happening right now, you know.
You think it was also a class thing? I mean, Rotherham was mostly lower class women, right?
That may have had something to do with it, but I tend to think class distinctions in today's world are actually overemphasized in some of these analyses. And I don't know if Cologne did have a huge impact. I think maybe we overrate that, to be honest.
It was more impact than the bombs, at least. I mean, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is that it was also quite unique as well. I mean, the bombing's just every day there's like a bombing or a stabbing or a truck running over somebody nowadays. But yeah, that's what we face. And I think in Europe, it has to be, we've got the tradition. We know what we need to return to, or we know the basic elements. I mean, there may need to be some concocting that goes on, but we need to sort of return to those traditions, understand them, feel in a way, and have an understanding of ourselves that is very similar to our ancestors. And I don't use that in the very parochial sense of ancestors, but you know this kind of this properly basic beliefs that were held by people that resulted in this inner domination. We have to recapture that to be able to overcome the perils of the modern age, and then it has to be acted upon in the right time and in the right place. And like I said, in Eastern Europe, I think that Christians, in particular the Eastern Orthodox, certainly need to begin to realize that they are going to be under existential threat, if not from liberalism, which is coming in, then later on from Islam, and they have to be ready for it. I have advocated for the formation of effectively an Orthodox version of Hezbollah, Hekamatu Theu, which would be to advocate for Orthodox interests against outsiders, and to provide in the same way that after in Russia, when Ivan the Terrible, when his reign was over and you basically entered this chaotic period of the false Dmitries, the church became basically the one unifying institution of Russia. Without the church, it definitely would have broken up into a million and one little states. But we need something like that again. I don't think the churches are healthy enough to do it themselves, because I think every church, even the Orthodox churches, which were famed by Bloomberg for quote unquote staying in the dark ages, they're a little sleepy. Everything is corrupted in the modern age. I think it has to come from an extra ecclesial organization. And I would like to at least lay the framework for such an organization being formed in those countries. I think it's necessary.
Well, I think that perhaps such an organization might not even be wrong in the United States. I mean, you think that it's a little bit, America does have identity in it. It just doesn't, it's perhaps not as historically elegant as it is in Europe. But yeah, I think that people need to start thinking about developing institutions that channel that identity. And I think
we need institutions that are separate from the current dominating institutions. And that's very difficult, because if you set up anything, the dominating institutions will want to know what you're doing and will try to get themselves involved.
Yes.
And that's the very dangerous thing.
We can't have nice things.
We can't have nice things, indeed.
That's the number one rule of progressivism, is you can't let conservatives have nice things, right?
Yeah. But I mean, at the end, people have to get out of the conservative mindset of, oh, we can just compromise with these people. Oh, the graceful thing for a conservative is to accept the change, even if he disagrees with it. No, realize that you're actually in a war. Realize that the ultimate end of this war will be your death. From the top, from the liberal intelligentsia of just massive apocalyptic self-destruction that they want to pour out upon themselves, because ultimately they hate themselves. But again, after that, from stronger cultures, united cultures, that always compete. Cultures always compete. Well, no, not competing in the sense, that's the wrong word. Cultures are always in a kind of evolutionary struggle. And if you show, two strong cultures can exist side by side, but if you have a strong culture and a weak culture, watch out, because the strong culture will eat your culture alive. And I think that we can see, if you want a lesson in that, go and look at how Islam spread across the southern Mediterranean. And, those places were simply not shored up enough in their culture, in their political institutions, and they completely got ridden over.
They were replaced.
Completely replaced. In more ways than one, they were completely replaced. The Copts are a testament, almost like a gravestone, to that Alexandrian legacy in Egypt. And it's gone. It's basically gone. I mean, I don't want that to happen anywhere else.
As a religious practitioner, I can't remember an Easter or a Christmas where in our prayers of the faithful, we didn't have to pray for a major terrorist attack against the Copts or another Eastern Christian variety. Like clockwork, every Christmas, every Easter.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is part of our modern age. I mean, we're dealing with Islamic fundamentalism in our age. And that is going to be, that's the major threat.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming up on our time. Did you have any final statements or final things you wanted to impart before we sort of closed up for the day?
Perhaps to say again and reiterate, I think there are people in these spheres, so-called, that often attach themselves to single issues. you know, they're very animated by some problem that they see, and you know, they want to talk about it. You see this with the manosphere, which is very animated about the sexual economy and the problems with women. You see it in the alt-right, where it's all really about race and racial replacement. But I would encourage people, you know, if you're in that bubble, it's okay to have a niche. It's okay to have something that you're very concerned about, whether it be for personal reasons or simple preference. But know that it's not one problem that we're dealing with. Solving one problem will not actually cut out the root of the problem. You actually have to really study where this stuff stems from. And Barry, I mean, with regards to the alt-right, remember race and that kind of, those kind of issues, they weren't issues on the right until mass migration began. You won't really find them in the 1800s talking about it, because it just wasn't an issue in Europe. There's nobody could imagine that as an issue. So you can tell that the right really transcends this stuff, and it goes back to those core sort of reactionary ideas. And all of the devolutions that we see today, all of these signs of decay, signs of collapse, signs of exhaustion, signs of that civilization winter that Spengler talked about, all of them are the result of this initial burst of liberal thinking, which then spreads out in a spider-like pattern of basically endless cultural, political, and economic revolution. And it has to go back to the root. It has to go back to first things. And that is again, where the reactionary parts ways with the conservatives, because he's not content with the status quo at all. He sees in history the tradition that he wants to bring back as the underpinning of society. And it doesn't mean he wants to return to some specific sort of idealized form in history. History doesn't really repeat itself in that sense at the superficial level. This is my problem with the legitimists. It's the underlying principles, the principles that existed as much in 300 BC as they did in 1300 AD. Those are the things that we want to sort of, harken back to almost, and those are the only things that I think can undergird a stable future for us, because I think without them we will be